18th meeting of the House Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules to order. And I will open a public hearing and work session on House Joint Resolution 25. Mr. Stenbridge?
Madam Chair, HJR 25 declares September 11th of each year to be Firefighter Appreciation Day. You have the Dash 1 amendment, which comes from the House Committee on Government Accountability and Information Technology, where this measure was first referred. It changes the name of Recognition Day to Fire Service Member Appreciation Day, and it changes the term firefighters to fire service members. It also changes the date from September 11th to January 27th.
Okay. And Shana, we have no one signed up to testify on this bill? Discussion? Vice Chair Buckley.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments to House Joint Resolution 25.
Vice Chair Buckley has moved the Dash 1 amendments to House Joint Resolution 25. Is there discussion? Yes, Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do we know why the change in dates?
I believe there's someone in the audience who might be able to answer that question. Could you please come forward? Good morning, and please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning. My name is Donna Dish. I'm with the Oregon Office of State Fire Marshal and Chair Rosenbaum and Representative Roblin. The changes are suggested because the January date is the first established date and we for a fire service in the nation. And in working with our partners in the Oregon Fire Service, they felt that September 11th is a rather sensitive date and that that date should be kept for honoring many, many others, in particular citizens. But the January 25th date is the very first established fire service organization in the nation. It was in Boston. And fire service involves so many people beyond just firefighters, and those two changes were made at the recommendation of a group of collaborative people with the Oregon Fire Service, including the Office of State Fire Marshal, but also the fire marshals, fire chiefs, who worked together for those recommendations.
Okay. Any other questions? Donna, you said January 25th, but the date here is the 27th.
That's what I meant.
That's what you meant.
Yeah.
Okay, I figured. Thanks a lot. Thank you for your testimony. And members, we are on the Dash 1 amendments. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Okay, the Dash 1s are adopted. And Vice Chair Buckley.
Madam Chair, I move House Joint Resolution 25 to authority be adopted as amended recommendation.
Vice Chair Buckley moves House Joint Resolution 25 as amended to the floor with a do adopt recommendation. Is there discussion? Shana, please call the roll.
Mr.
Berger? Aye.
Mr. Buckley?
Aye.
Mr. Estabell?
Aye.
Mr. Hunt?
Aye.
Mr. Roland?
Aye.
Ms.
Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Rosenbaum? Aye. Motion carries. Do we have a volunteer to carry this on the floor? Representative Estabell will carry. And I will close the public hearing and work session on House Joint Resolution 25. And I will open a public hearing and work session on Senate Joint Memorial 3A. Mr. Stenbridge.
Madam Chair, SJM 3A urges the President of the United States and Congress to re-examine the nation's foreign policy towards Ethiopia, condemning a dictatorship that opposes and abuses the citizens of Ethiopia.
Thank you. And no one has signed up to testify. Perhaps you didn't realize we have a sign-up process, but that's fine. We can have you sign up. Do you want to take the sheet to them so they can sign up? And you're here to testify on Senate Joint Memorial 3A? Okay. Thanks. Please go ahead. And please begin by identifying yourself for the record.
You can start with the
motion. Madam Chairwoman and members of the Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules, my name is Lulit Masfen, and I'm a resident of the city of Portland. I represent the Ethiopian American Council an organization dedicated to the promotion of human rights, democracy, and the rule of law in Ethiopia. I'm appearing before this committee today to testify in support of Senate Joint Memorial 3A. I have a prepared testimony which I've provided, which I'll provide to the committee staff. I respectfully ask the chair to accept my prepared testimony into the record of this proceeding. Madam Chairwoman, I support Senate Joint Memorial 3A for the following reasons. The memorial recognizes the long and productive friendship that has existed between the United States and Ethiopia. The memorial is prepared in the spirit of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and Friendship to the people of Ethiopia. The memorial clearly expresses the democratic sentiments of the people of Oregon in encouraging the formation of democratic institutions in Ethiopia. The memorial is outstanding in urging the President of the United States to encourage the head of the ruling regime in Ethiopia to release all political prisoners and respect for the rule of law. Madam Chairwoman, I support Senate Joint Memorial 3A because it goes a long way in standing up for freedom, human rights, and democracy in Ethiopia, for the democratically elected members of the Coalition for Unity and Democracy Party, civil society advocates, human rights defenders, free press journalists, and against tyranny, persecution, and oppression in Ethiopia. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. I would be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you for your testimony. I think we'll hold questions till we've heard from the entire panel. So please go ahead.
My name is Don Lieber. I'm a resident of Portland. I'm a freelance journalist. I spent a good portion of the past 6 years in and out of Africa and the Horn of Africa region in particular. And prior to that, I was I worked at the U.S. State Department in D.C. For 6 years, and a portion of that time was in the Bureau of African Affairs. And I appreciate very much that the committee is having us today to speak about a country that is not on the everyday radar of our media or our attention in general. I was in Ethiopia this past year on two occasions doing several stories, and I wanted to share with you some of my observations that relate to the consideration of this resolution or memorial today. Excuse me. And I want to read to you from my prepared testimony and then speak briefly on the human dimension of this, which is, I think, at the core of where we're coming from. And I would like each of you to consider that in particular. The Ethiopian government of Meles Zenawi, the Prime Minister Meles Zenawi, denies the citizens of Ethiopia the most basic human rights and civil liberties that we in America take for granted. This has included the rigging of national elections, mass arrests without due process of law, closing down the press, torture and killing of peaceful civilian protesters. to the extent of which the Washington Post last year included Prime Minister Meles Zenawi on a list of the world's worst dictators. That was in an article from April 23rd, 2006, the Washington Post. According to the Post, Zenawi is responsible for, quote, the gunning down of scores of demonstrators and putting prominent opposition politicians on trial for genocide and treason. Thousands of alleged government critics have been harassed, imprisoned, tortured, and killed in the past decade. Millions have been intimidated into silence. Ethiopia is sub-Saharan Africa's second most populated nation, with about 80 million people. The only country in sub-Saharan Africa with more people is Nigeria. About half of the population in Ethiopia is Muslim. The other half is Christian. Geographically, it's a vitally strategic, the country has a vitally strategic importance to us in America. It sits on the it borders with Somalia, Sudan. It's in close proximity to the Red Sea and the Saudi Peninsula. So it's important that we look at this in geopolitical terms here in the interest of the United States and our security, as well as our ethical and humanitarian concerns. So I wanted to speak briefly about the issue of freedom in Ethiopia. In short, it does not exist. It has been stated that Prime Minister Zanawi is an ally of the United States. My observations on the ground and from speaking with many people from all different walks of life in Ethiopia, he's actually considered...
You don't actually need to have your mouth so close to the microphone.
I'm sorry.
It's better if you pull back a little bit.
I'm sorry.
It's a very sensitive microphone.
Okay, thank you. It appears that Zanawi is more of a mercenary. In fact, his record proves he's a ruthless and as dictatorial as any of the administration's more publicly condemned enemies of freedom. Zanawi is an enemy of freedom. In the past 2 years, there has been an alarming deterioration of freedom in Ethiopia. This includes the suppression of free speech, suppression of dissent, suppression of the right to assemble, suppression of independent media, suppression of civil society organizations, arbitrary and political arrests, lengthy imprisonment, torture, and so on. The Ethiopian government has shut down the independent media and arbitrarily jailed scores of journalists. One Associated Press reporter, Anthony Mitchell, who in an unrelated incident was killed last week in an airline accident, he was kicked out of Ethiopia last year. In the government's words, his articles were, quote, tarnishing the image of the nation. So there's hardly any critical journalism allowed in that country. The organization Reporters Without Frontiers ranked Ethiopia 160th out of 168 nations in the world, the eighth worst country in the world for press freedoms. It is ranked worse in press freedoms than Zimbabwe, Sudan, and Syria, nations that we're well familiar with for their dictatorial governments. Ethiopia is the second worst ranked country in all of Africa for press freedoms. It's a draconian, undemocratic government. The May 2005 elections resulted in a surprisingly strong showing for the opposition, a coalition of various organizations that believe in free market economies, democracy, human rights. But before the election was over, the government canceled the results and announced its own victory. The European Parliament, U.S. congressional delegations, and many others around the world and in this country condemned this action as a stolen election. Peaceful protests ensued, resulting in the shooting deaths of 200 civilian protesters. An independent inquiry commission concluded that the government was to blame. When this commission was scheduled to release its report, or just prior to the commission's releasing its report, two of the commission's authors fled the country and their families out of fear of government retribution. People in Ethiopia live in fear of expressing themselves. In November 2005, the government arrested the entire leadership of the opposition, the CUD party, Coalition for Unity and Democracy, that's the name. 175 members of the coalition were arrested within several days, along with dozens of journalists and human rights activists. The charges included treason and genocide. Those charges bring the death penalty. These charges were widely condemned and remain condemned as outrageous, with no merit, by organizations such as Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and others. Who are some of these people? To give you an idea, who are these people that have been arrested and charged with genocide? And this brings a little bit of a personal face to it. Just in brief, I'm going to speak briefly of two of these who remain in jail to this day. Dr. Bahana Nega, as one of those arrested. He was, it appeared he was about to be elected as the mayor of the capital city when he got arrested. Dr. Naga was the recipient of the 2006 Alumni of the Year Award from the New School of Social Research in New York. He studied in the United States. He's a well-known international economist. He taught economic theory at Bucknell University, received his PhD from the New School of Social Research in New York. He had opportunities to remain in America, but instead he chose to return to Ethiopia and to contribute through private entrepreneurship to help this very poor country of his. He founded, among other organizations, he founded the Ethiopian Agro-Maize Company, a company which made much-needed fertilizer. Now remember, Ethiopia land, we know, is continuously at a state of famine or near famine. And this is a man who was committed to the betterment of his country and the particular needs. So he started an organization that made fertilizer out of city waste. He also founded Village Family Home Builders that helped provide affordable housing. He then taught pro bono as an economics professor at the Addis Ababa University. He also has worked as a consultant for the United Nations Economic Commission for Africa. I met with his wife while I was in Ethiopia. His wife, her name is Dr. Nardos Manasseh. She's also has very close ties with the United States. She was trained as an optometrist here in America. She holds U.S. citizenship. She also, like her husband, could have stayed in the United States and done quite well as an optometrist. Instead, she returned to Ethiopia, where she practices optometry now. She has two sons, aged 13 and 11. They visit their father once a week, as I did when I was in Ethiopia. The jail is a converted stable. So his two boys visit him with guards positioned on each side, as close as I am to Lulit. They visit once a week for an hour. The family and the father is separated by hay where the animals used to feed. Dr. Nardos told me shortly after his arrest, armed police entered her home without any warrant, without any explanation, ransacked and confiscated most of the home's belongings. They took clothing, they took CDs, they took books. She goes out to this day frequently noticing unarmed security forces following her. These are good people. These are people that could help their country. These are people with ties to America, and they love our country. They don't know where else to turn for help. Another of those imprisoned is Professor Mesfin Waldemariam. He's 76 years old. He's the founder of the Ethiopian Human Rights Council. He's an internationally acclaimed human rights defender. Last year, he was nominated for the European Parliament's annual Andrei Sakharov Human Rights Award for his lifelong commitment to a more just and humane order in his country of Ethiopia. When he was arrested, he was charged with genocide and treason. Those who know him would laugh at that charge if it wasn't so tragic with some severe implications. These people remain in jail to this day. Well, what's behind some of these draconian measures?
This is extremely important, but we also do have a room full of people who are here to testify, so if I could ask you to just kind of summarize.
I'll wrap this up. Sure, thank you very much. Let me quote from a bipartisan congressional resolution from Republican Representative Chris Smith of New Jersey and Democratic Representative Donald Payne, also New Jersey, who said in explaining these arrests and this dictatorship, and I quote, "These measures were deliberately taken to stifle and criminalize opposition party activity in the country. The measures were also intended to intimidate and silence independent press and civil society." So I urge this committee to pass Senate Joint Memorial 3. and take a stand on ethical grounds. It's in the interest of the United States and the state of Oregon to align ourselves in the name of freedom and democracy. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Did you wish to testify as well?
I just have some written testimony I'd like entered in the record.
Oh, that would be great. Yeah. We'll definitely read it if you... Have you given it to our committee assistant? Okay, any questions for these witnesses? Okay, thank you very much for bringing this to us, and thank you for your testimony. Members, we are in a work session. Yes, Vice Chair Buckley.
Madam Chair, I move to send Joint Memorial 3 to the floor with a to-adopt recommendation.
Representative Buckley moves Senate Joint Memorial 3A to the floor with a to-adopt recommendation. Is there discussion? Yes, Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to say real quickly, since my high school days, this has been a country in Africa that has had a great interest to me. The life of Haile Selassie and some of the other issues from the Second World War on, as well as its place in both the archaeological history and the cultures of Africa are pretty important. So I am pleased to be able to support this motion.
Thank you. Okay, Shauna, please call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Motion carries. Representative Roblin, would you like to carry this on the floor? Okay, we will have Representative Roblin carry, and I will close the... And thank you very much for those who brought this before us and came to testify today. I'll close the public hearing and work session on Senate Joint Memorial 3. And I will, I see Representative Smith is here with us, so we'll open a public hearing and work session on House Bill 3556. And Representative Patty Smith, can you please come forward? Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you very much. The Honorable Chair, thank you for hearing this bill, and Vice Chair Berger and esteemed committee members. I thought I had a great committee. This is a great I'm State Representative Patty Smith, District 52, Multnomah, Clackamas, and Hood River County. Probably one of the most scenic districts in the state. I just thought I'd throw that in.
Get it on the record.
Did we vote on that?
We debate on that.
Sorry that you vote on. I always say that. Senator Meskin, I always say that. I'm here today to ask for your support in passing House Bill 3556. And I want to thank you for hearing this bill. And it's a much-needed task force dealing with our food safety program here in Oregon. This is important to all Oregonians, especially to consumers, since the papers recently have been filled with numerous reports on the pet food recall. And as you can see by Sunday's paper, and I didn't even have time to make a copy of that, we now have it maybe in our fish feeds that was delivered to our hatcheries. So we don't know the extent of the contamination. We need to do everything we can in Oregon to protect our food supply. From producers to consumers, that's why I used a priority bill to create a food safety task force. And I've submitted my written testimony along with copies. And I just wanted to tell you why I brought this bill. And the urgency is the need to address the issue of our food safety. And that's important to all consumers, whether it's pet food or consumer food or whatever food. We want to be assured, and the Department of Ag has done a wonderful job. I can't say enough about what they've done. But that being said, as consumers, we rely upon those issues. We rely upon regulations and inspections, and so I have done this bill in order for us to make recommendations to come back next February, which we're going to come back, and I voted for that. And we usually don't do interim committees until, you know, late in the fall or early next year. So I wanted us to put priority on this, and I've kept it very small to keep costs down, and I see it doesn't have a fiscal impact or not determined, so I would urge you to pass this food safety task force, and let's look at the issue and make recommendations to come back next February if we need to be. So I'd be glad to answer your questions. Or
thank you, Representative Smith. And I realize that I neglected to ask our committee administrator to summarize the bill, which we is how we usually start.
Okay.
So would you like to do that?
I'd be happy to do that anytime you wish. HB 3556 creates a five-member task force on food safety to study and report on the safety of human and animal food production, manufacture, distribution, and sale in Oregon, to be staffed by the Oregon Department of Agriculture. It declares an emergency, taking effect upon passage.
Thank you, Mr. Stembridge. So, committee members, any questions for Representative Smith? Thank you for bringing this before us. And yes, Vice Chair Bruce.
Yeah, I'm reading through the bill, and you asked for questions. I really don't have a question, but I would like to make a comment, and that is that if you look through the material that Representative Smith has provided, all of a sudden, this out of nowhere popped into our radar screen. Sure. Who'd heard of melamine? Obviously, you know my attitude about pets. I wasn't. but immediately when this thing came forward, I think we all said, well, wait a minute, where's our pet food come from? And then the next question is, well, wait a minute, where does our food come from? And so I think it is important that we get ahead of this in Oregon and not wait until there's a further tragedy. So I really applaud Representative Smith for coming forward and saying, you know, we have an obligation, and I like this approach without going overboard, but have somebody taking a look at where our food is coming from and what's in it, and what we can sort of be looking towards to protect the safety of the food supply in Oregon. I really appreciate this bill.
Thank you, Representative Berger, for that comment. And Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. I don't have questions for Representative Smith, so but I did have a few things to add to this. I had a recent experience with pet food. Got my dog to take him into the vet. He was just not feeling well. And eventually, they asked me, well, what kind of food are you feeding him? After they had tested his blood and said it's as if he had eaten antifreeze, which he had not. I mean, there was not any access to that where he was, unless he was purposely poisoned, which we determined later that it was the food that had been recalled just a few days before we had bought the new bag, and he'd been eating it a few days and not feeling well, and we almost lost it a couple times, and it's scary. So buy domestic. Well, stuff is manufactured here in the United States without the ingredients from other countries right now until things are clear. So.
Well, I appreciate the comments, and I want to thank you for hearing this. As again, I said, we've worked on this continually, and they do a great job. We just got to make sure we're in a global economy now. It's different. It's just different. And I feel like Kim Thatcher does, or Representative Thatcher, that, you know, I love my dog and my cats. I just, you know, they rely on us to feed them, so what are we eating? So.
Yeah, I know. I've been reading the labels on dog food and cat food and biscuits and everything else lately. And I think the thing I was thinking of, too, Representative Smith, is that when that whole spinach scare was going on, that I went out to dinner at a restaurant in Portland, and there was a dish on the menu with spinach, and my husband was planning to order it. Then he said, well, I suppose you won't have the spinach. And they said, well, actually, we get our spinach from one place here close by. We know where it comes from. We don't have any concerns about it. And I think that, you know, Oregonians really do value the security of our food supply, obviously, and particularly when they can get their food locally, you know, more and more, I think people really appreciate being able to do that. So I think that this is a great addition to people's sense that somebody's looking out, because what we are becoming aware of is that at a federal level, there are too many agencies with overlapping jurisdiction. And so I think if it's something we can take some control over locally, that would be great.
I agree.
So I appreciate you bringing
Thank
this to
you
us,
very
too.
Much. Thank you.
Any other comments or questions for Representative Smith? Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And next we'll call Erica Hagedorn and Dalton Hobbs. Did you both wish to come up together? Are you together? Okay.
For this purpose, sure.
Great. Good morning. Welcome
Good morning.
To the Elections
Go
Committee.
Ahead.
Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee, I'm Erica Hagedorn here today representing the Northwest Food Processors Association. We're submitting written testimony to you from our Government Affairs Director, Bruce Anderson. We just want to voice a little bit of concern about this bill. I'm going to leave the technical food safety issues to Dalton. I'm not that kind of expert. But food safety has been a major concern for Oregon food processors since the NWFPA was formed in 1914. We've been working with the ODA on these programs for years and support ODA's experts in the field. They sit on national food safety committees. They work with the USDA, have a large contract with the USDA to regulate food safety programs here in Oregon. Food processors have a vested interest in making sure that the food we produce is safe for Oregon families to eat. In 2005, we helped lead efforts to increase fees for the food safety program that the ODA runs on ourselves because we have that much of an interest in making sure that people are confident that the food they're feeding their families is safe. We're concerned that House Bill 3556 creates a false impression that Oregon has a food safety crisis. To those unfamiliar with our process, the tacking on of the emergency clause looks like an alarm rather than just something to move a bill on faster. We'd be happy to coordinate with the ODA for informational hearings or any sort of information that members need, but we feel that unless there's a specific concern that the legislature has about our food safety supply, our food supply, that it shouldn't be addressed in a task force. And again, we'd be happy to answer any questions, but at this time we just feel that unless there's one specific concern, we shouldn't be giving the public undue alarm about the quality or safety of Oregon products.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Yes, Madam Chair, for the record, I'm Dalton Hobbs, Assistant Director for the Oregon Department of Agriculture, and I'm here today to provide information on House Bill 3556. The Oregon Department of Agriculture's Food Safety, Animal Health, Pesticide, and even our Commodity Inspection Divisions operate under broad authorities provided in both statute and rule to ensure that there's the food and animal feeds in the state are safe and wholesome. And as you can imagine, ensuring a safe and wholesome food supply is a complex and important responsibility. It means that we work closely with other agencies, such as the Health Division and the Department of Environmental Quality at a state level, and then the FDA and USDA on the national level. And indeed, we've even begun to work with counterpart agencies offshore to ensure that the imported foods that could end up in our foods here are safe as well. Recent headlines regarding spinach, pet food, and even now hatchery trout feed brings into focus how complex the task of ensuring a safe and wholesome food supply is. We believe this legislation will create a task force to study the issues related regarding the safety of the manufacturing, distribution, and sales of human and animal foods here in Oregon. This task force could help our agency explore a number of ways to optimize our food safety programs, while at the same time it reviewed both statute and rule to recommend what, if any, changes need to be made by the next legislature. I think it's important to note that there is not a crisis, as Eric has suggested here. Although the marketplace and the world context in which foods are manufactured and distributed has changed, it is a global economy, and I think it is often wise from time to time to take a look at the systems that are in place to see if they are optimal in terms of being able to ensure that we do have a safe and wholesome food supply. So I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have, and thank you very much for allowing us to speak today on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Dalton. And you, so the department, I did have a brief conversation with the director, too, and she indicated that you would be able to staff this, and yes. We're prepared to do so. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, we are prepared at this point to staff this and to proceed ahead with this effort if we receive that direction from the legislature.
Yes, Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Eric, just to clarify again, because you mentioned the emergency clause, but just to clarify for the record, that is standard procedure for bills that go into effect immediately, just so that's on the public record, that this is not a particular case that was singling out the food processing industry or imports or anything else. Standard procedure. Just to clarify that. And I don't know if you'd want to respond to it, but since this is in the headlines, this is in the news, I think there's an expectation that we would at least find out as much information as possible, and the bill does require a report back to the legislature. And just speaking personally, I appreciate all the education I can be offered in terms of how the industry works and what safeguards are in place so I can communicate that to my constituents.
Chair Rosenbaum, if I may, Representative Buckley, I think the Northwest Food Processors appreciate definitely the educational opportunity that this is affording us today. Our problem is the public perception, that if the conversation continues, then people are going to be walking through their grocery stores picking up items and wondering if they're safe. And we'd be happy to walk anybody through a food processing plant. There are several around Salem. We just want to make sure that all of you have the information about how ODA's food safety programs are some of the best in the country. We want to make sure everyone's confident about that.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Berger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Erica, I think that I would like you to go back to your folks and assure them that I have it's sort of like both sides of the coin here. We as a legislature need to assure the public that we aren't ignoring the headlines. And I think that you as an industry need to assure the public that you're not ignoring the headlines either. And rather than wait for the next crisis, I think this is an important thing that we, as a legislative body, and I think you as an industry, need to say, yeah, we're looking at it. We're looking at it. We now have full warning from incidences that it needs to be looked at. And I think in the end, what it'll do is validate the work of your industry in our state and say, we're not the problem. We're the solution. And so I would say that, yes, I understand the emergency clause piece and there's enough panic out there, but I think I would turn this around on you and say to your industry, help us reassure the public about Oregon's food supply by coming to the table and giving us real facts, not headlines. So thanks for coming forward, and that's sort of the message I would send back to your industry.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would add to that, because I noticed that some of the language in the letters refers to undue public, that this could cause undue public concern. I would say that the public concern is there. And just adding to what Representative Berger was saying, I think it would really ensure Oregonians and give us peace of mind if we really knew what was going on. What do we do? What processes do we have in place? You know, perhaps suggesting improvements if there is any room or if that's merited at all. I just think that would actually help you also, just like Representative Berger was saying.
Representative Roblin?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And I guess my comment would just be that, you know, having been on the Agriculture Committee this session and having gone to some national conferences regarding food safety, we need to be proud in America of having kind of the most abundant and best food in the world, and we continue to do that. Oregon needs to be proud of the food that we make here because it is some of the best in the world. And when we do all of our, you know, niche marketing to the rest of the world, which is happening more and more in the state, it is because we do such a good job and our processors do a great job. And I would hope that this would just reinforce that. I think that hopefully as we go through this bill, what we will be able to do is highlight by Oregon, because over and over again it's going to say, if you want stuff that's good to feed your pets and good to feed yourself, by Oregon. So, and I will push that as this goes, if and as this goes through, that will be a message, because I think it's pretty clear that it's been that way for a long time in our state. We take all of the kinds of issues very seriously, from the producer all the way back to the farmer and all the things that we do. And I think it's highlighted that some people, some other countries don't do that. And I think that we should highlight even more that, you know, we are one of the few states in this country which can be self-sufficient just because we produce so many different things in our state. So I concur, and I hope that this continues to show that point, and also to say, hey, be careful when you buy stuff that comes from other places. Oregon does it right, so I agree.
Yes, I'd like to thank the committee members for their comments, because that's exactly, I think, the spirit in which I see this as something that can reassure Oregonians and also reinforce people's already very strong inclination to buy locally and have confidence that we're doing something to keep people safe. So I think the industry is represented on the task force, and hopefully it will be seen not as a negative thing, but as something that will just reassure people. So thank you both for your testimony. And members, we are in a work session. Yes, Vice Chair Berger.
I move House Bill 56. I wanted to get the number right. To the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Berger moves House Bill 3556 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Shauna, please call.
That's okay. That's good. I'm just hoping that Rex and Roman would say "Bye, Oregon" one more time.
Okay, Shauna, please call the roll.
Aye.
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 Goodbye.
Yeah, whatever.
Aye. Aye. Motion carries. I think we all say bye, Oregon. And I think I will ask Representative Smith to carry this on the floor. And I will close the public hearing and work session on House Bill 3556. And that brings us to our remaining bill. I'll open a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 3539. And Mr. Stembridge.
House Bill 3539 requires employers to accommodate employee religious practices. It requires employers to allow employees to use available leave to accommodate employees' religious observances, subject to the employer's ability to adjust the employee's work schedule or assignment. It requires employers to allow employees to wear religious clothing and to take time off for religious observance if the impact on the employee's job performance is only temporary or tangential. Do you have an amendment to this, which came late? And
the dash one.
The dash one, it came late on Friday, and it cites the specific statute for undue hardship in Oregon law.
Thank you, Mr. Stembridge. And I see Representative Hunt has joined us at the witness table. Good morning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Representative Dave Hunt from Clackamas County. We've had an interesting morning. Firefighters, foreign policy, food safety, and now religious freedom. Maybe foreshadowing of the rest of our time together this session as a committee. This bill is really a follow-on to a bill that former Representative Gordy Anderson and I and a bunch of others introduced in the last two sessions. In the last two sessions, we had very broad bills focused on religious free exercise, completely all-inclusive of everything. And the challenge of that is you get into so many different areas and so many complexities that the bills kind of imploded upon themselves because there were so many issues involved. The attempt of this bill is to focus on one specific area, which is frankly what the federal government has been doing since a Supreme Court decision in 1990, throughout really decades of case law around religious free exercise. And so Congress came back and did a specific bill protecting institutionalized persons, those in prison, specific legislation protecting religious free exercise and the land use. They actually have a pending bill very similar to this, which is sponsored by Senator Ted Kennedy from Massachusetts and Senator Sam Brownback from Kansas, kind of an interesting political odd couple, that would be in the same area of workplace religious freedom. And you'll notice the dash one really do, because by deleting lines 5 through 21, this is really a replacement of the text. The basic question here is, what's the starting assumption in terms of free exercise in the workplace? Is the starting assumption that it should be allowed, or is the starting assumption that it should be restricted? This really codifies in statute the starting assumption that free exercise of religion in the workplace should be allowed, especially in specific areas. Specific areas like using leave specifically for the purpose of religious observance or practices, a very reasonable test. Allowing religious free exercise specifically for wearing religious clothing in the workplace. Taking time off for a holy day, participating in a religious observance or practice. Now, you will notice it does have in there an exemption where the employer can restrict the religious free exercise, but only in a case where it imposes an undue hardship on the employer, and that references a specific statute that is already in Oregon law. But other than those cases where it's an undue hardship, the assumption is that the employee can not be required to work on a holy day, can be allowed to take a break to pray in the middle of the day, can be allowed to wear a yarmulke in the workplace, can be allowed to do the kind of things that are consistent with their religious free exercise. Frankly, if you ask Boley today what they advise employers to do, they will say, even though there's not statutory grounding for it, they advise employers to accommodate religious free exercise. The challenge is right now that there is really not a statutory grounding for what they're advising employers to do today. So this really does specifically put it in statute. I've got some experts in this area of law at the state level and at the national level who are behind me. I am not an attorney, as you all know, so I would encourage you to ask them the questions related to legal interpretation. But the real goal here is, how do we, at least in the area of employment, and frankly I hope we come back in future sessions and get into some other areas, because there are other areas that are challenging where we currently are restricting religious free exercise. One of the ones that's been in the news in the last several months has been the OSAA case, where they are prohibiting the Seventh-day Adventist school, or requiring the Seventh-day Adventist school to play on a religious a day that they set aside for religious observance, therefore meaning that team does not play and cannot play in those tournament games. This bill doesn't deal with that, but I frankly am one who thinks we should deal with that in the future. But this focus is just on the area of free exercise connected to the workplace and connected to leave. And I would urge your favorable consideration and urge you to give the hard questions to the people behind me.
And Representative Hunt, I think looking at the statute that this goes into, I assume it's the Bureau of Labor and Industries that would enforce this?
Correct, Madam Chair.
And questions for Representative Hunt? Vice Chair Berger.
Yeah, two questions, if you'll indulge me, please, Madam Chair. The first is for Representative Hunt directly, which is, why was I not asked to sign on to this bill? And we'll leave that in the rhetorical. And the other question really is not for Representative Hunt, but anticipates the panel that will come, and that is how there are cases where religious clothing can be a hazard in the workplace and what accommodation is made for that. And I see nods behind me, so I'm sure you hear from them on that. Thank you.
And I might just say, Madam Chair, Vice Chair Berger, this was a priority bill for me, which got drafted very late in the process, and therefore, I didn't happen to see you that day. Be happy to have you sign on now.
Representative Esquivel.
Yes, I too have some concerns about the clothing part of it, which I've expressed with the people in back of you. I interview you. I expect a professional attire, and then all of a sudden you change. And you have the law to protect you. That isn't what I hired. How do we cope with that?
Madam Chair, Representative Esquivel, I think especially in cases where it is a religious clothing that is really especially required by that person's religion, I would assume that they would have that clothing on when you would interview them as well. It's not a case of, my religion does not require me to wear specific clothing. So for my religion, that would be optional. There are other religions, though, where that is very much required. An Orthodox Jew would be expected to wear a yarmulke. They would have that yarmulke on when you interviewed them, as well as when they showed up for the first day of work. So I don't. It's certainly not intended. I don't think in practice it would be a gotcha kind of kind of situation between employees and employers.
Follow up?
Yes, go
but
ahead.
But you are assuming.
Madam Chair, Representative Esquivel, I think the experts behind me will be able to better speak to that.
Yes, Representative Thatcher.
Maybe a question better left for the experts left behind you, but just to give them a heads up, I have some questions about using vacation leave, and that's fine, but how far do you break down vacation time as far as increments of vacation time? Is it half days? Is it 10 minutes at a time? You know, I'm just wondering what is reasonable accommodation at that point. I just, if somebody wants to take time off to pray three times a day at 10 minutes each, is that part of their break? Is that part of their vacation time that you're going to have to parse out over, you know, half hour a day? I'm just curious about that.
Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher, I think I will leave that to the legal beagles behind me.
Okay. Looks like you've exhausted the questions. Thank you for your testimony. Next we'll call Greg Hamilton, James Standish, and John Stemp. Members, just to clarify, we are in a public hearing and work session on this bill. Good morning. Please go ahead.
Good morning, Madam Chair and distinguished committee members. My name is Greg Hamilton. I'm president of the Northwest Religious Liberty Association. The Northwest Religious Liberty Association represents the constitutional and workplace discrimination concerns of the Seventh-day Adventist Church and all people of faith in the states of Alaska, Idaho, Montana, Oregon, and Washington. We are very pleased that House Majority Leader Dave Hunt and Representative Roblin are sponsoring Oregon House Bill 3539. It is a bill which specifically restores the statutory obligation of employers to demonstrate that they did everything possible to accommodate the sincerely held religious beliefs and practices of their employees before legitimately claiming that such beliefs and practices posed a significant difficulty and expense for their business. We accept the latest amendment proposals, including the language of significant difficulty and expense, along with the other lines that were added. From 2005 to 2007, the Northwest Religious Liberty Association has mediated 131 workplace situations in the state of Oregon alone, and a total of 362 in the states of Alaska, Idaho, Montana, Oregon, and Washington combined. The types of cases we mediate typically involve religious minorities who seek an accommodation to work on their holy days or Sabbaths. This is usually a one-day-a-week commitment backed by a sincerely held religious belief and or spiritual requirement to observe the Sabbath according to their scriptures or Bibles. These religious minorities often involve devout Sunday Sabbath keeping Christians, respectful Muslim citizens who keep Fridays, Orthodox Jews and Seventh-day Adventist Christians who keep their Sabbath from Friday sundown to Saturday sundown. This list also includes Sikhs, Jehovah's Witnesses, and Latter-day Saints. It needs to be understood, however, from our point of view, that it is religious minorities who often struggle in vain to balance their sincerely held religious beliefs in the workplace with their employers' or supervisors' demands to work their Sabbath or follow whatever religious belief or custom they are required to follow. Please understand that these people do not go out of their way to be difficult employees. Just the opposite is often the case. They seek to be the best employees, the most competent, the most skillful, and the most productive. And they often are. Since the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in 1977, a case known as TWA versus Hardison, a de minimis standard has been applied. This de minimis standard reinterpreted the federal Title VII provision of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 to conclude that employers were not required to demonstrate that they did all they could to accommodate an employee's religious requests before claiming an undue hardship on their business. We believe that sincere people of faith should not continually be forced to choose between their place in employment and their faith. We believe House Bill 3539 would happily balance the business interests of employers, both small and large business owners, with the sincerely held religious beliefs and practices of employees. It is a great bill, a bill that truly represents the best of America's traditions, religious freedom, as House Majority Leader Dave Hunt mentioned earlier. With this test, as George Washington once wrote, in this land of equal liberty, it is our boast that a man's religious tenets will not forfeit the protection of the laws of the United States. With this testament from our country's greatest founder in mind, and in the spirit of attempting to truly guarantee the Title VII religious freedom rights of religious minorities in the workplace, the Northwest Religious Liberty Association respectfully urges you to pass this bill in committee and send it to the Oregon Assembly for a vote. I would like to introduce you, if you have questions, to James Standish, president of the North American Religious Liberty Association and co-chairman of the National Coalition on Workplace Religious Freedom in Washington, D.C. He is to my right. John Stump, he is a former employee of Horizon Airlines here at PDX at Portland International Airport. He is now a flight instructor in Houston, Texas, that trains Indian Airline pilots in Houston, Texas, and he has a specific testimony in regard to religious discrimination that occurred to him in the workplace and was found as such by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. So if you have any questions, great. If not, we can start with James.
Yes, we'll hold questions till you've all testified.
Okay.
Please go ahead.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, it's an honor to be here with you. I flew in last night. My plane was delayed. If I'm a little bit groggy, I didn't get to bed till I think 3 a.m. East Coast time and up at 4:30 a.m. today, so West Coast time. So I don't know whether I'm coming or going, but it's great to be here, and it's a great opportunity to spend some time together. I co-chair a coalition for freedom of religion in the workplace that is a coalition of national religious organizations, 44 national organizations in the coalition, everyone from the American Baptists through to the Sikh American Committee, from the Religious Action Center of Reform Judaism through to the United Methodist Church, a really very, very broad group of religious entities. I actually, Exhibit A in the handout is a list of the whole gamut. We don't agree on much. We certainly don't agree on theology. Don't even get us started. What we do agree on, though, and we don't agree on much as far as public policy either. We have a very broad views on a lot of the sort of hot button issues of the day. So it's unusual that we've all come together, and the question, of course, has to be asked: why? Why have we come together to support religious freedom in the workplace, and why now? Well, the answer is that the issue of religious accommodation in the workplace has become a much more critical issue for people of faith in America. We don't just say that because of anecdotal evidence, although most of our communities do have significant anecdotal evidence from our own communities that things are not getting easier for people of faith in the workplace. Whether you're Jewish, you're Muslim, Christian, whether you're Sikh or Hindu, things are a little bit more complicated. But we don't just say that from our own sort of anecdotal evidence. The U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission keeps statistics on the number of claims they receive regarding religious discrimination. The number of claims received by the EEOC, Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, Washington, went up 82% between 92 and 2003. 82%. That is an enormous increase. Now, when I tell people that, the response is, we're just becoming a much more litigious society. Let's face it, you know, we're more willing to complain. Well, that would be a good answer if the claims were going up across the different categories of discrimination. But during that same period, claims of racial discrimination and gender discrimination both held roughly steady. And claims of age discrimination actually declined fairly significantly, about 15%. So it's not that all claims are going up at this meteoric rate. claims of religious discrimination have. Now, the question is, why would we have such an enormous increase in the number of religious discrimination cases, claims at the EEOC? Well, no one has done a systematic study, but there are some ideas that people have put out that may explain why we're having such an increase in the claims of religious discrimination. The first is that we've moved increasingly to a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week economy. Those faith groups that have a holy day, whether it's a weekly holy day or an annual holy day, increasingly accord in the middle of that. One of my favorite stories is how John Kerry, Senator John Kerry, got involved in this bill. He had a complaint from a constituent, two Catholic women who were workers at a dog track in Massachusetts. They asked to have Christmas Day off. Okay, their employer refused to accommodate their requirement. When they did not show on Christmas Day, they were fired. And I often joke with people, if Catholic women can be fired for observing Christmas Day in Massachusetts, who is safe in America?
That's right.
Unfortunately, increasingly the experiences of whether you're observant regarding a weekly Sabbath on a Sunday or a Saturday, or whether you have periodic holy days, Jewish high holy days, whatever it is, that's butting up to this 24/7 work week. The second reason we think that possibly the claims have increased is that our society is becoming more religiously diverse. And that diversity is not just simply because our immigration patterns have changed in the last 10 to 20 years, where we have a lot more folks coming from Asia and Africa with religious traditions that are less familiar to sort of a Christian or Jewish perspective. It's also because the immigration patterns inside the country have ensured that communities that were once fairly homogeneous, both ethnically and religiously, are now more diverse. One of the sponsors in the House said that he knew that there was a diversity when he grew up. There were people from North Germany, people from Central Germany, and people from Southern Germany. And now they have a big community from the Sudan in his hometown. Well, it turns out that a significant proportion of the folks that they have there are Muslim, and so all of a sudden the idea of religious diversity goes from maybe Lutheran and Catholic to Lutheran, Catholic, maybe a few Pentecostals and evangelicals and what have you, to Muslims. And this creates a whole new sort of paradigm of thinking through how these communities relate. The third reason is after 9/11 there was a significant spike, particularly for Sikhs, who are not Muslim, as you know, but because they wore turbans, some people, not everyone's very sophisticated about world religions, let me put it that way. And a Sikh cab driver was actually murdered in Arizona after 9/11. I don't know if you guys remember that, but because somebody said, I saw the Taliban, and they were wearing turbans, there's a guy driving a cab, he's wearing a turban, connect the dots, this guy must be the problem. Obviously, both incorrect on so many levels, you don't know where to begin, but also just a profound ignorance of world religions. Well, it turns out Muslim women were increasingly asked to remove their veil, their headscarves, excuse me. Sikh men asked to remove their turban, and ironically, and I'm not sure why this is, but one of my colleagues who works for the representing the Orthodox Jewish community also reports that increasingly Orthodox Jews were asked to remove their unique religious clothing and headgear, both for men and for women. And then finally, maybe the reason why we've had such a big increase is that we're increasingly becoming a materialistic society where our mercantile interests trump everything, whether it's family or other issues that are out there, but including our spirituality. The bottom line has become the bottom line, and the values that are hard to put a money dollar figure on, and maybe we're getting to be a little bit careless with, even though it is those values that created this country. Well, in response to this problem, there's a federal bill called the Workplace Religious Freedom Act, which somewhat tracks what is proposed here in Oregon. Particularly, that bill would require employers to accommodate the religious practices of employees, unless by so doing the employer incurs a significant cost or inconvenience. If an employee can show it's a significant cost or inconvenience, they don't have to accommodate the religious practices of the employee. The bill has not yet passed. We hope that it will soon. But it's encouraging to me personally, and I think to many members of the religious community, that states are starting to look at this issue, because often the federal government is very slow to address Syria. You know, it's hard to get things done in Washington. It's a difficult place, and as I sometimes joke, for every action there's an equal and opposite reaction in Washington, so it takes a while to get things moving forward. So let's look at some of the objections to increasing the protection for people of faith. There are two principal objections, that it will first harm business, and second, that it will create third-party harm, that is, it will harm customers or other employees. And when I deal with the harming business, I'll talk a little bit about some of the objections, some of the questions that were raised here. We do not believe that this bill will harm business. It won't harm business because generally there are easy ways to accommodate people of faith, whether it's the schedule issue or the clothing issue. And indeed, in many cases, there are employers in a given industry that regularly accommodate, and yet there are some that say they can't. In other words, when there's a will, there's a way. Currently, the law is so weak that there's very little incentive for recalcitrant employers to go to meet people and really work through these issues. Secondly, we don't believe this is going to increase litigation because there's no incentive to litigate in this area. The damages that you get in these cases are typically lost wages. Lost wages in these cases are typically very small because the people who are getting hit are the people at the bottom end of the economic scale. I'm a lawyer and I have an MBA. I work for a major law firm. I worked for also worked in the business world. Never had a trouble getting accommodated, even though, as you know, major law firms, and some of you may have worked for them, they're pretty brutal as far as hours go. But if I had to do it, I'd come in Saturday night and work the hours and Sunday and what have you to get the job done. It's not people like me who are getting harmed. It's people who are on the line, who are working low-paying jobs. And as a result, the amount of damages, even if they're out of work for a fairly significant period of time, tend to be very, very small. So if you're making $20,000 a year and you're out of work for a quarter of the year, your lost wages are only $5,000. Now, how quickly do you burn through that when you're litigating a case? You know, as far as legal fees go, very, very quickly. That's why when you look up in your yellow pages, you don't see a lot of lawyers. You'll see slip and fall. You'll see, have you had problems in the hospital, what have you. You're not going to find a lot of lawyers advertising, had trouble with your religious accommodation in the workplace? Call me. Most lawyers run the other direction. In fact, many of the cases that are dealt with now are dealt with by nonprofit organizations like Greg here. And I think most of those organizations would dearly love to be out of this business because it is it's a money loser. It's a resource taker. And that will not change even once this bill has passed. The third reason why we don't think this is going to result in greater litigation is that New York State has adopted a very similar standard to the standard that you're considering today. It adopted that standard back in 2002. Since that standard was adopted, the number of religious discrimination claims actually dropped by 41% between 2002 and 2005. 41%, a pretty significant drop. One of my favorite quotes that comes out of the New York experience comes from Attorney General Elliot Spitzer, who is now governor of New York. He said, "I have the utmost respect for those who are critics of WERFA, but on this issue, they are simply wrong. New York's law has not resulted in the infringement of the rights of others or in the additional litigation that they predict. Nor has it been burdensome on business. Rather, it strikes the correct balance between accommodating individual liberty, the needs of the business and the businesses, and the need to deliver services." I want to just talk about third-party harms very briefly, and that is some have said this will result in employees refusing to deliver services or products to employees. We don't believe that will be the case. Very simply put, it hasn't happened in New York. New York's a very diverse state religiously. And in addition, I used to, in my prior life, was a healthcare administrator. And I know what it's like to deal with issues of provision of care on a timely basis from an administrative perspective. And the idea that folks would be, that could legitimately sort of exert this right and say, you know, I'm not going to provide care on a timely basis, and that any court would find that that is not a significant burden on the employer, I think is fanciful. It hasn't happened in New York. It won't happen in Oregon or nationwide. Let me just answer just a couple of the questions that were, a couple of the issues regarding safety. It's a serious issue. We take it seriously. Obviously, we don't want people in flowing clothing working around spinning machines or people refusing to wear hard hats and all those sorts of things. Once again, if an employer can show it's a significant burden, they do not have to accommodate the religious practice. Health and safety is the heart of what is a significant burden on an employer. And once again, New York, they just haven't had the problem. And they have a significant Sikh population as well as many other groups. As far as a professional dress code, the issue that comes up with garb is nearly, I shouldn't say exclusively, but the cases that I'm aware of and that come up have to do with particularly headscarf, turban, yarmulke, and a few other similar type issues. I think in most of those cases, the person can be accommodated without compromising professional dress code. A classic example is uniform codes where you have, for example, a blue hat and you have a Sikh gentleman wanting to work for you. Well, what most employees do in that case is say, okay, not a blue hat, wear a blue turban that matches the color, and many that's done in many cases, although not this bill doesn't reach the military. I should say in many militaries have done, like the British military have done the same thing with their uniform requirements, and so has a number of police forces. I think the New York Police Force has a blue turban for those folks. As far as breaks for prayer, which is another issue that comes up, particularly regarding the Muslim religion, what I often respond to folks who raise that is, do people get breaks for cigarette smoking at your employment place? You know, do people get smoke breaks? And I think for most employers, the answer is yes. Well, if somebody takes 10 minutes to go out and smoke, why can't they take 10 minutes and go out and pray? It hasn't, in functional terms, it hasn't been a huge issue, but as far as I'm aware, I'm not aware of cases that actually litigate where that issue has been litigated, but I'm not saying it won't happen. Let me just finish with one final thought, and that is, this is a nation founded by many of the founders of this nation were religious refugees. My own family originally were from the eastern part of Germany, now Poland, and they fled Germany at that time because of religious persecution. That's why they left Europe. That's maybe why some of your families left Europe and came to the New World. This country was built on an idea, and that idea was that our fundamental freedoms, religious freedom being the first mentioned in the Bill of Rights, are sacrosanct, and that this country, the people who wanted to live their lives consistent with their religious beliefs would be allowed to do so. Unfortunately, today, increasingly, men and women of faith are being arbitrarily fired for no crime other than trying to observe their religion to the best of their knowledge and ability. This bill does not require every person to be accommodated in every perspective. It's a balancing test. It's a reasonable test. It's a test that's worked in another state that's very diverse and very complex. And we believe strongly that if Oregon goes ahead and adopts this standard, you'll be leading the country. You'll be standing up for religious freedom and fundamental human rights, and you will be an example to the rest of the nation and indeed to the federal government as we struggle with these issues on a nationwide basis. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Morning, Madam Chairman, distinguished committee members. My name is Jonathan Stump. I currently reside in Houston, Texas area. I'm a certified flight instructor at MVP Aero Academy. I currently instruct many Indian Airlines students that come over under their direction. I'm a former employee of Horizon Airlines and worked as a baggage handler from 2001 through 2004. The following piece of paper you're probably getting right now is a testimony regarding my difficulty with Horizon Air to observe my Sabbath faithfully and keep my job. From February 2004, I'd been accommodated with my Sabbath and my religion by Horizon Airlines through shift trades and also scheduled bidding for Friday nights and Saturdays off. February 10, 2004, a new bid packet came out here in Portland, where I was currently stationed, that did not offer any Fridays or Saturdays off for employees, and particularly new employees to that station. On February 15, after not being allowed to bid a Friday or Saturday off, I went to my pastor and asked him for guidance and requested letters of accommodation from him, and also gave requests from myself to my current employer. On March 1st was the first time I was able to speak to my employer. He finally acknowledged that he had received the letters, and he told me outright that Horizon Air does not request honor requests for religious holidays, period. This was later confirmed by my mediator, Greg Hamilton, in a phone conversation with the lead corporate attorney at Horizon Airlines in Seattle, that this was currently corporate policy. I asked my supervisors what I should do. They said, you can try to shift trade those Sabbaths away. I was made available for shift trades. I put them all up on the board, and only one of them was taken by other employees. This left the other three Sabbaths within that month uncovered. And leaving me with the choice between violating my sincere belief in keeping the Sabbath or coming under fire from my supervisor. For those three Sabbaths that I was not, that I did not have coverage arranged, I did not go into work, but my shifts were covered by on-call employees that were always on hand to cover shifts for sick people or for those who did not show up for whatever reason. Later, my supervisor came to me, told me of corporate policy. After three times missing, I would be given a letter of reprimand and possibly fired. He later told me that he did not want to mess with the company's seniority system by upsetting 100 other ramp employees by giving me special consideration in the matter of my Sabbaths. That was on March 8th of that year. I would either have to show up to work or be fired. March 9, I received my first official communication from management that they that I must find a way to get Sabbaths off. That I must find a way to get Sabbaths off because it would cause an undue hardship on the company by depriving other workers of their own seniority rights. The next Sabbath, March 13, I did not show to work. Sunday, I picked up extra shifts. I was at work at that time. Monday, March 15, I was called into the office and given three options. I was to either resign, be fired, or take administrative leave for 30 days without pay. I obviously chose the third option, which involved turning in my employee badge, turning in my uniform, and also working with human resources to find another job that would suit my current position within 30 days. The next morning I called Human Resources, requested a packet of those jobs that were available to a Sabbath keeper. I was sent a packet a few days later. I found a variable time position as a drug test coordinator on Tuesdays and Thursdays. I interviewed for the position. I was the only one internally that interviewed for the position. I was qualified at the time, but the human resources director called me later, early that morning on the day of the decision, and told me that The requirements were now that I must work holidays and weekends. And then asked, what was my decision? I obviously told her no. On March 17, the 30 days were up. On March 20th, at a face-to-face meeting with HR, where I received my letter of termination, which did not state the facts accurately, completely regarding why I was terminated, but only stated that I was terminated for insubordination. I was referred to the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industry by Charles Standish, or Steinbaugh, I'm sorry, and Bully referred me to the Federal Equal Opportunity Commission. I filed a claim of religious discrimination with them, and they did a formal investigation, and on July 2, 2004, they informed me that they were going to build a case for formal charges against Horizon Airlines. They found in my favor, saying that discrimination had occurred and that the burden of proof was in their court, so to speak. Policy-based discrimination was found, and that Horizon Airlines does not honor the request for religious holidays or Sabbaths, period. Thanks for the opportunity to share my experience with you. If you have any questions, I'd be willing to take them now.
And, Jonathan, what was the remedy that was ordered as a result of the complaint?
The complaint through EEOC, we didn't, I think I dropped the ball somewhere along the way. I was currently in another position in New Jersey, towing banners at the time, and many things were piling up. The remedy with Horizon Airlines was, you know, that I would have to find the job within the 30 days from the list that they would give me, which only included one position that said, you know, Tuesdays and Thursdays were the only days that I would have to be at work. And when I interviewed for that position, they told me that, yes, it was only Tuesdays and Thursdays. But then HR, the next morning, the day of the morning that I was to be called, called me and said that, you know, I was now required to work Saturdays and weekends and holidays as well.
And Vice Chair Buckley?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two questions, if I may.
Go ahead.
Jonathan, prior to your employment, did you discuss with Horizon your work schedule needs?
Yes, I did. And through shift trades and able to bid my Sabbaths off, I was able to do that. When the new policy or the new bid forms came out, there was nothing available for me to bid those Sabbaths off, so I attempted to do those shift trades. It was a larger station, which is Portland. I was working at it Walla Walla at that time, before I came to Horizon Air Portland. They out there accommodated me very well. Here at this station, they did not accommodate me here at all. So.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mr. Standish, the New York legislation, is it also called the National Workplace Religious Freedom? Can you, I just like to look it up and
sure.
Get some more information on it.
Thanks. Fortunately, the last attachment to the handout, which is actually the testimony of my colleague Richard Fulton from the American Jewish Committee that he put in at the to a federal congressional committee, outlines the parameters of the New York experience, including providing the precise reference point for the law there in New York.
Just clarify, Madam Chair. So,
yeah.
So if I looked up the Workplace Religious Freedom Act from New York.
No, it is on the first page, second paragraph. They amended the religious accommodation provision of its human rights law, which is found at New York Executive Law Section 296, subsection 10.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
That's what I was looking for. Thank you.
Sometimes finding these things can be tricky, but Richard did a very fine job, I think, laying out the precise parameters of the New York law in that attachment. So that's why I included it, because it's, I think, a great example.
Representative Roblin?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess this one would be kind of to the New York experience as well. There have been a number of court rulings with respect to public employees, teachers and others, and a religious garb, based on the Establishment Clause, basically. So those would still stay in place. I mean, a public employee would still have to abide by those rulings.
Yes, sir. The Federal Workplace Religious Freedom Act does not deal with federal employees, and I'm not sure how the state act would, the reach of the state act would be. The federal employees actually have a very a good level of accommodation through any through guidelines that were issued during the Clinton administration that give a substantively fine balance between the rights of the employer and the rights of the employee, and we have very few problems with federal employees. This doesn't impact the Establishment Clause, and I want to make that clear. This is obviously a statute. It deals with private the private employees. It doesn't purport to deal with federal constitutional issues or Trump state constitutional issues. It is statutory and thereby subordinate.
Other questions? Yes, Representative Thatcher.
Yes, going back to my question about praying certain times a day, you're also commenting on the fact that this affects line employees mostly. Well,
yes.
Very often during work situations, you're told as a line employee, you start here, you have your break at this time,
mm-hmm.
mandatory. You have your lunch at this time, you have your break at this time, you go home at this time. Those times where they have breaks and lunch may not necessarily line up with their times that they would need to, have a religious accommodation.
Sure.
And that's why I'm saying it might fall outside of those break times like you're referring to with smokers.
Sure.
And so at that point, how would you envision parsing out vacation time or what have you?
Yeah. You're asking a very, very good question. And just as a point of reference, it turns out I grew up for about 6 years in Malaysia as a young man, I'm used to Islamic cultures, predominantly Muslim country. And believe it or not, they do have factories and all the things that we have. In fact, they have very successful manufacturing there. I'm not an expert on exactly how strict the time parameters are for praying within the Muslim faith. What I do know is that I am not aware of a single reported case that deals with that issue, and when we've talked with folks both in New York and at the EEOC in Washington, it's just not an issue that's come up with folks demanding to be accommodated at particular times. It could be, and I can certainly go to some of the Muslim groups that represent the faith community, that their times for prayer are a little bit less, it's five times a day, but precisely what times, I'm not sure, are regimented so tightly that they couldn't do it during morning, bathroom break, smoke break, the usual types of things. Which is my suspicion. I'm not certain of that, but my guess is that's the reason why we're just not seeing those kinds of cases coming up.
Sure. I was just getting on the internet and wondering, well, isn't this already against the law? And don't get my position wrong. Don't get me wrong. I totally support what you're doing. It's kind of pointed out on one website, NOLO, who they claim themselves to be the world's or the nation's oldest and most respected provider of legal information for consumers and small business. Okay, so I just put a plug in for them. But however, they mentioned in an article, on the one hand, you can't make employment decisions based on religion, but on the other hand, you're having to take an employee's religion into account when making certain workplace decisions, and that is because it's not just a characteristic, it's also a set of practices and beliefs. So I guess we're talking about freedom of conscience here. But then also looking on the U.S. EEOC website, there's Q&As on there. And one is, can my employer refuse to grant my request to wear religious garb, such as a turban, because it might make coworkers, clients, or customers uncomfortable? And it says no. Employers may not refuse your request, on and on. What are some common religious practices that might require workplace change? And go on and explain, well, it could be accommodating, Sabbath, a religious holiday, etc. And so it appears that it's already against the law, and I'm just wondering, is that
excellent question,
not the case?
And congratulations on doing good research, even with the most respected source. but to go to the EEOC's statement, the Title VII of the U.S. Civil Rights Act requires employers to make reasonable accommodation for religious practices unless by so doing the employer incurs a, quote, undue hardship, which begs the question, what's an undue hardship? It wasn't defined in the statutory language. Originally, the EEOC interpreted it to mean that an employer must take significant steps towards accommodating. But that issue went all the way to the Supreme Court in a case called TWA versus Hardison, because it's an issue of statutory interpretation, because the statute itself doesn't define what undue hardship means. The Supreme Court found that undue hardship means anything that is above a de minimis cost or inconvenience. De minimis is the word. It's a fancy way of saying very minimal. Or as Richard, my co-chair, often says, it means ain't much. It means the standard's very, very low. And if an employer can show even the most trivial cost or inconvenience, they often can prevail. And in some district courts and circuit courts, there's a second problem with the current standard. So currently the protection is exceedingly low. It's the lowest form of legal protection you can have. You can't get much lower than de minimis. Because, so that's the first problem. The second problem is in some circuit courts and some district courts, they've interpreted the accommodation requirement to permit a reasonable accommodation to be a partial accommodation. Let me give you a great example of this. The employer says, we'll accommodate your Sabbath practice. We'll let you off every second Sabbath of the month. We'll meet you halfway. But of course, if you're an observant Jew, for example, you can't sort of be observant one week and then sort of non-observant the next. And most religions are not, I mean, some religions are that flexible that you can do that, but many religions aren't. And as a practitioner of one that isn't, it's no accommodation at all. So you have a very, very low standard where what the EEOC is giving very broad sort of advice, and I'm glad that that's what they have on their website. On the other hand, I've been to employment law seminars where this issue has come up, and the advice that's been given is, you got an employee, you don't want to accommodate them. Well, can you come up with some kind of inconvenience to you? Can you come up with some kind of cost? Yeah? Well, most of us are creative enough and knowledgeable enough to do that. Well, then if you really don't want to accommodate, you don't have to. Now, there's always a chance that, you'll be, that the claim would go through the EEOC and so forth. But the chance of that is pretty low. There's no money in this. Chances that you do this and don't suffer any negative consequences are pretty good. And even if it does go through the complaint process, the chances that you will prevail are pretty good. If you can show that there's a more than a de minimis cost or inconvenience. Now I want to talk to maybe.
We have a floor session at 10 o'clock. Sure. Members, we have been excused very briefly, but we do have two more witnesses signed up to testify, and I'd like to hear from them as well. So we really appreciate you traveling such a long way to be here with us today.
It's an honor.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
I'll call Emily Gottfried. Good morning.
I had said I would have, excuse me, some written testimony, but I noticed that Richard Fulton's testimony is attached to James Standish's testimony, so that would be duplication. So if you'd like my own personal testimony, I can share that with you later. But I don't need to put Richard's in. Okay. Good morning. My name is Emily Gottfried. I serve as executive director of the Oregon chapter of the American Jewish Committee, a national and international human relations and advocacy organization, which since 1906 has been a vigorous proponent of the free exercise of religion, not only for Jews, but for people of all faiths. Madam Chair, thank you for this opportunity to testify before the Oregon House Committee about the Oregon Workplace Religious Freedom Act. We greatly appreciate the leadership of Representatives Hunt and Roblin in introducing this important initiative to protect religious liberty and safeguard against religious discrimination. AJC, nationally and locally, strongly supports this important civil rights legislation.
Nationally, AJC serves as co-convener of a broad coalition of over 40 religious groups, which you heard described earlier, that has come together to promote Workplace Religious Freedom Act, federal religious freedom accommodation legislation introduced in the U.S. House of Representatives. Even as the U.S. Congress considers this initiative, we commend the sponsors of House Bill 3539 here in Oregon for taking the initiative at the state level to enact the protections against religious discrimination that this bill embodies. In doing so, you're following a precedent established by New York State in 2002. The organizations making up the WRFA coalition hold a broad range of positions on many public policy issues, not the least of which is separation of church and state and the meaning of the First Amendment's No Establishment Clause. Yet, despite our differences on important issues, we are united on a fundamental principle that no employee should arbitrarily be forced to choose between obedience to his or her faith and keeping a job. Current federal civil rights law defines as a form of religious discrimination the refusal of an employer to reasonably accommodate an employee's religious practice, unless such accommodation would impose an undue hardship on the employer. Unfortunately, this standard has been judicially interpreted in a fashion that places little restraint on an employer's ability to refuse to provide religious accommodation. While there are a number of problems as to how the federal religious accommodation law has been interpreted, the core problem has been the court's crabbed reading of the term undue hardship as meaning anything more than a de minimis or trivial difficulty or expense. The result has been that religiously observant employees are needlessly forced into a conflict between the dictates of religious conscience and the requirements of the workplace. The good news, however, is that since the problems in this area turn on judicial interpretation of legislation rather than constitutional doctrine, they're susceptible to correction by federal or state legislation, enhancing the obligation of an employer to provide reasonable accommodation of a religious practice. Thus, House Bill 3539, once it is amended in the fashion that we understand has been accepted by the sponsors, will define undue hardship as an action requiring significant difficulty or expense. In this respect, it is in line with the definition of undue hardship set forth in the Americans with Disabilities Act and in New York State's religious accommodation law. In short, House Bill 3539 is crucial civil rights legislation meant to ensure that all members of society, whatever their religious beliefs and practices, are protected from this form of discrimination. The refusal of an employer, absent undue hardship, to provide reasonable accommodation of a religious practice is nothing less than a form of religious discrimination that stands between Americans and equal employment opportunities. It's discrimination when an employer refuses to make an adjustment in a shift schedule so as to avoid compelling a Seventh-day Adventist to work on his Sabbath, premised on the argument that even the administrative effort involved in arranging for such an adjustment amounts to an undue hardship. And it's discrimination when an employer refuses to allow a Muslim woman to wear the modest garb required by her faith while on the job, simply because this is not the standard uniform worn by employees. Finally, I want to stress that while HB 3539 strengthens the employer's obligation to provide a reasonable religious accommodation, it does not give employees a blank check to demand any accommodation in the name of religion and receive it. The employer's obligation to accommodate remains linked, as it is under federal law, current federal law, to an appropriate balancing test that gives substantial regard to the legitimate needs of business, including the need to avoid negative impact on fellow employees, customers, and other third parties, even as it somewhat levels the field for an employee in need of accommodation. It's crucial that we preserve both religious freedom and the integrity of the workplace. The American Jewish Committee urges the Oregon legislature to act promptly to enact legislation that will do just that, and that is the Oregon Workplace Religious Freedom Act. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And we have one more witness, Andrea Meyer. Please come forward. And members, we will not be working this bill today because we are waiting for an additional amendment.
Good morning. Good morning, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon, here today indeed to actually ask you not to move this forward today. I want to say at the outset, Representative Hunt referred to the OSAA case. That is an ACLU case that we have been litigating for years on behalf of Seventh-day Adventist students for the OSAA to make even minimal reasonable accommodations. They're currently before the Supreme Court on interpretation of an older Oregon statute and what it meant at the time it was passed and whether we incorporate federal standards. So who knows? We may be back before you after the court eventually rules on that case. It has been years, and unfortunately those students have not been able to participate in the basketball tournament, and they were quite a successful team. So we are quite cognizant of the concerns and dynamics around reasonable accommodation law. However, ACLU, our national, does oppose the Federal Workplace Religious Freedom Act of 2007. We have significant concerns for unintended consequences. We are looking to a narrower language regarding accommodating workplace schedule changes for observation of religious holidays and wearing religious clothing or beard or hairstyle. What I have not been able to do, because I've just seen these amendments, is ask my national folks to please look at this language and see if this raises any unintended consequences and concerns with either undue hardship with some of the language around it. On its face, it appears limited to the areas that I think we're most interested in seeing some change, but I would hope to have the opportunity to have them look at that in light of our ongoing opposition to the federal legislation in this area. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, and members, I think that completes our sign-up sheet, so we will be taking this bill up again soon. And I will close the public hearing.
Well,
and
if you want to carry over to Wednesday, you better say so.
So I'll close the public hearing and work session on House Bill 3539, and members, we are adjourned.
Thank you.